Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bry.
Good morning. Happy Thursday. All right, Thursday. We got a lot going on today. So I guess, of course, we're going to talk about the big, beautiful bill passing.
It's a budget bill.
So we're going to talk about that next. But we wanted to start with transparency. Are we going to get it from DOGE? Because you said this to me yesterday, like, we have to talk about this. Because the Trump administration is asking the Supreme Court to block an effort to open the inner workings of the secretive DOGE, or doggy, cost-cutting effort to public scrutiny. I feel like we're going to agree on this.
Yeah, we are, because as a former elected official, I understand why this stuff is important. The public has a right to know. They have a right to access the information that's being shared among government officials, about agencies, about the work they do, about the money you spent, the communications you have. And this one, of all this promise of transparency, this pisses me off.
Well, and that, I think that's the bigger thing. Of course, the transparency is important, but the show, the amount of lip service about transparency that Elon Musk had going into this position, and then the bait and switch of, oh, never mind, we want this to be sealed and never to be seen from again, as far as what we were actually doing in the first 90 to 100 days, because they can't actually, like, they dismantled agencies, they laid off federal workers, they cut funding to U.S. programs, and they've saved the United States $160 billion, but third-party groups have found that it will actually cost, what they've done so far is actually going to cost the country $135 billion. So there are literally no receipts to what they've done besides sowed chaos.
Let me cut through the BS here. Whatever they promised they found, and again, I'm a person who believes in small government, real efficiency in government. This is not that. Whenever you see people put up smoke screens or post things that we're saving you all this money or indiscriminately fire people and then have to hire them back, that suggests inefficiency and the wrong way of doing something. And, you know, this is also a violation of a lot of different things. One, the Freedom of Information Act, clearly. Lower courts have said that. I have no idea what the Supreme Court will do with this, and I hope they do the right thing. But this argument that the White House is making and government lawyers, essentially, is that this is an office of the president, and therefore doesn't require that sort of scrutiny. I'm not buying that. If you really believe in transparency, if you really believe in efficiency of government and finding out how we spend our money, how DOGE spends our money, how DOGE actually documents and details what they are supposedly saving us, that's the exact reason why we should have transparency. And this idea that we're going to sort of insulate that office exclusively from what should be a crystal clear lens for the American citizen to see what the government is doing is inexcusable. And I want a conservative out there to defend this. It's not the way we do business.
Well, Bill will be here tomorrow, so maybe he can defend.
That's going to be one of the questions
because
on our list.
This is the other part of this, as we've now seen Elon Musk kind of retreat from not because he's still around, right? He was in the meeting yesterday with the president of South Africa.
Sure.
He's still kind of there, but he's not as front and center as he was in the first 3 months of the administration. But I remember multiple people making the argument. He's the richest man in the world. He's doing this as a favor, right?
Oh,
like,
yes.
Why would he do this? But let's think about some of the deals he's now had access to do by being the first buddy, right? He's now Starlink, which is his internet company. He has deals with Saudi Arabia, India, Somalia, Lesotho, and some other ones. And so then, and also now SpaceX is potentially going to see billions of dollars in federal contracts under this new administration.
Yeah.
His other company, the Boring Company, is in talks with Amtrak to take over the building of the Frederick Douglass Tunnel program, and multiple investigations that were like going on against Trump's companies have now been dropped, or there's agencies that were charged with investigating them that have now been slashed. And so it's like he had a lot to gain financially by being there. It wasn't just like out of the goodness of his heart to make things better for the government.
A 3-judge panel in D.C. already rejected this idea that there's a separation here, that they can make this argument that it doesn't fall under the Freedom of Information Act. And I'm not buying it. And I think the Supreme Court has an obligation to keep transparency alive, the idea that we should know what our government is doing. When you're looking at these high levels, and we're talking about, you know, this office of DOGE looking at Social Security, our transportation systems, right? FAA. There's an argument to be made that they've actually messed up. They can blame it on the Biden administration, and maybe some of that's true, that the you know, sort of lack of infrastructure, although I'm sure they allocated a lot of funding for that, that maybe didn't get approved by Congress. Time will tell, or a good reporter will find out that for us. But I think at the end of the day, I want to know what this is about. And if Elon Musk and Donald Trump and the administration really believe that this is the best way to do business, I got to question that. Freedom of information is there for a reason. We should know what our government is doing. And that includes DOGE and everybody's favorite billionaire, Elon Musk, not mine. Point taken?
We're off to a good start.
All right.
Stay with us.
Thanks for tuning in on this Thursday edition of Point Taken. She's Chris and I'm Steve. All right, the big... I hate even saying it.
I was thinking about that on the way in today. I was like, what are all the B words that we could...
Beautiful, budget,
brutal,
bountiful. I don't know. Anyway, past...
Bad.
Past 215 to 214, only two Republicans voted with Democrats. And you have a great point, but let me just tell people who
all right.
Representative Thomas Massie from Kentucky and, of course, Warren Davidson of Ohio voted against the measure. Andy Harris voted present, which is, I have to dig into that a little bit, what the logistics of that were. But the interesting point you raised to me that I didn't think about yesterday as this was approaching was...
So it's 215 to 214.
One vote margin.
And Jerry Connolly died yesterday.
Yes.
And he's the third Democrat to die since March in office. Like,
yeah.
I know this is going to take us down a totally different... Because we want to talk
relevant.
About the bill.
It's
we want to talk about what's in the bill and where it goes from here. But just to think about, this goes back to, because after the bottom of the hour, we're going to have a urologist, Dr. Keekley's here to talk about prostate cancer and the Biden diagnosis. But in general, the conversation around if you are battling health issues, do not run for reelection, especially when you're in the House and you're up for reelection every 2 years. Like the fact that we had three people who died less than 6 months after, or let's say 6 months after they were reelected, is unimaginable to me.
I will give Republicans credit, and I'll give Speaker Johnson credit, because I know Bill Mikosch is going to talk about this tomorrow. He seized the moment.
Well, he also needed Trump to come in there and basically, like, be the mob boss to threaten people.
Yeah.
I mean, Trump got on, was giving a press conference after he talked to everyone yesterday and was talking about Massie, and he's like, I think he should be voted out. He doesn't understand what government is.
Let's hear from Speaker Johnson.
This is the first important step in opening up the reconciliation process. We have a lot of hard work ahead of us, but we are going to deliver the America First agenda. We're going to deliver all of it, not just parts of it, and this was the first step in that process.
He's right. First step, because reconciliation has to sort of reconcile the bill with the Senate. Senate will have different things to say about it. I don't think he's going to get everything he wants. I don't think the president's going to get everything he wants. But at some point, this will pass. I wanted to give equal time to Hakeem Jeffries.
What was his name?
Hakeem.
There you go.
What did I say? Hakeem.
You added a syllable.
Yeah. Hakeem Jeffries, who speaks in response to some of the things that are in the bill and his party's take on it.
Republicans are lying to the American people about Medicaid. The Republican budget authorizes up to $880 billion in cuts to Medicaid that will hurt children, hurt families, hurt everyday Americans with disabilities, and hurt seniors.
Hakeem Jeffries from the House on his response, his party's response to the big, beautiful budget bill. Now, the Medicaid thing is interesting. So there's a couple pieces that Republicans are hanging their hat on. One is this fraud thing they keep talking about.
Yeah.
You know, more than a, you know.
I saw a great thing yesterday that was making the count of all the guys doing their, you know, cable news hits and having a clicker and a counter for how many times they said white males living in their parents' basements,
right,
playing video games, and this like idea that these are the people who are taking advantage of the system.
Yes, and there's always fraud in every government system. I'm not saying that there isn't. The other piece is this community engagement requirement. So 80 hours of work per month or education or service for able-bodied adults with dependents.
And so, do they get into what is an able body?
No. And here's the other kicker. You know when that starts? When do you think this starts?
2028?
2029.
Okay.
Guess who's out of office by then?
Well, we'll see.
Yeah, we'll find out. Donald Trump leaves office. And people, the other requirement, people have to verify their eligibility for the program twice a year versus once. So we're going to constantly renew that.
So here's my question. What happens to single moms who have to choose between working enough to pay for childcare, which they probably can't afford anyways, or not working to take care of their children because they can't find a job that would pay for childcare, but now they don't qualify for Medicaid because they're not working?
It makes that question even more difficult for young moms. Or moms, or dads that they're in that same situation, because there's dads that have that are single parents.
Sure,
it makes it much more difficult. And here's the nonpartisan, supposedly, Congressional Budget Office says these proposals, if all of them pass through the Senate reconciliation, get to the president, he signs it, 7.6 million people will be impacted by Medicaid changes. Some of the people you just talked about,
a lot of children too.
Yeah, and. They haven't even gotten to the Affordable Care Act, which they would like to shoot down at some point as well. And that would also impact those groups that you just talked about. That's just one piece of this thing. Some other highlights, if you want to call them highlights, because again, I'm not big on the promises of debt reduction, because the Congressional Budget Office said this will actually add to the federal deficit, not trim it, which is what the White House just said this morning. This is going to save billions of dollars from the federal deficit, trillions of dollars, I should say. Which, again, show me something. Some of the other pieces. Let's get to some of this stuff. Obviously, the big thing that people point to is tax cuts, right? It's sort of the – Spinal mentioned this on Monday. Sort of reestablishing the 2017 tax cuts. Make them permanent. That's what it'll do. President Trump promised he would do that. To offset that loss in revenue, Republicans are proposing or phasing out all of the clean energy stuff that was passed during Biden's presidency, which they hate. And that's supposed to bring down this burden, which is what they call the actually all these things the government does for people, by about $3.8 trillion. Again, all of these things are like imaginary. It also includes, and this is a real thing, so I'm not going to say it's not, $1,000 increase tax cut for individuals, $16,000 for individual filer deductions, $2,000 boost for joint filers. So the deduction piece is important. That's sort of what Spano was talking about. There's also a temporary $500 increase in the child tax credit. So a little something good there, which now brings it to $2,500. And there's a increase for inflation. The estate tax exemption rises to $15 million. Man, if you have a state worth $15 million, you're doing well. It certainly
you,
protects
you don't?
I don't, no. I wish I did.
I wish I did, too.
There's a lot of other things. This is the one that's sort of painful, the food aid one, which you and I have talked about before. It really hits hard on the SNAP program.
Yes, which, again, it's 81% of the recipients live below the poverty line.
I'm not sure why that's popular among anybody, but...
And so many of them are children, and it's just... This is just exhausting because I feel like, and I would love to hear from someone on the text line who makes, let's say, less than $80,000 a year. What in this bill, from what you understand, you think is good for you? Like, what, if you make less than $80,000 a year, what in here will make your life better, easier, richer? Because I just am reading this, and I understand that I'm biased, but I can't wrap my head around how this is good for working people.
One more thing before we go to break here. There's $150 billion for the new Golden Dome.
So we can afford that, but we can't afford to feed children.
Quick break here on Point Taken, Kristen and Steve. One of the interesting consequences of this bill could be an impact on rural hospitals
and
medical centers.
Which is already a huge issue.
Yeah, it's horrible.
I mean, I think about this with my own family's health, living in Wisconsin Rapids, which they live down the street from a hospital that is very limited in any kind of serious escalation. They need to go to either Wausau or Marshfield or Madison. And so they're for my Uncle Doug right now, every time he needs to see the doctor, my mom's driving 2 hours to get to Madison to get the care that he needs. And that's not even that far compared to what a lot of people have to deal with. And so the amount of more rural hospitals we're going to see close down and people driving longer distances and maybe not getting the care that they need in emergency situations, like it just in general, more people are going to die.
I spent some time on social media this morning kind of looking at the reaction to, that people had to this. There's two things that would be impacting people's lives that may change sort of the conversation about this budget and the, maybe the future of this country. And that's Social Security, which has been being messed with, including by DOGE, and healthcare. And if people start feeling that pain, if you don't have a place you can go to get your healthcare, or, you know, we see the rates of disease, death, everything that ails us go significantly up because we have, now we have a, you know, RFK Jr. in charge.
I was going to say, is RFK Jr., where is he on all of this as far as making us healthier again?
I'll say it because maybe people are afraid to say it. He's an absolute loon running a very important agency. And I, you know, the fact that people aren't talking about this more is concerning. There's already numbers that suggest all of the rates are going up for disease and infections and that stuff in this country. And he just got there. None of this is good news. We're actually going to stay on that theme in the next half hour. We got a great guest.
Yeah, so Dr. John Keekley, who is a urologist with Aurora Healthcare, I got to interview him last November for Movember, but we thought it'd be good to have a conversation with him as far as debunking some of the assumptions and myths around President Biden's prostate cancer diagnosis that we found out about this week, because I think there's a lot of people who thought they overnight became experts in the topic on what it means to get a diagnosis like this at 80 plus years old. And so we're going to have him come in and talk a little bit through and also probably give some advice for men who are approaching that age and what you should do to keep your eye out for your own health. So I'm really looking forward to that conversation.
Yeah, as am I. He's going to stick around for a couple segments. So I'm looking forward to that. We have local news with Jessica Tai. You can hear in the midday as well.
Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. He is Steve Scafidi. And we are joined now by Dr. John Keekley, who is a urologist with Aurora Healthcare. And we wanted to have him come in, not for his political hot takes, but obviously this week, your profession has been very popular. A lot of people think that they know all the things you went to med school and all of your expertise, because after President Biden's diagnosis came out, a lot of speculation happened of, how long has he known? Has there been a cover-up? How could it be this far along without having some people know? So as far as you've followed the news so far, Dr. Keekley, is there anything about his diagnosis that strikes you as unusual?
Honestly, no.
Okay.
You know, the current guidelines for prostate cancer screening recommend cessation of screening after age 70. I will say in my practice, and I think a lot of urologists practice, we do continue screening patients, you know, for a longer period of time than that based on patient preference. But it really does involve a pretty thorough conversation between the physician and the patient, engage in something called shared decision making to really decide whether you do want to continue screening beyond age 70.
Is 70 just an arbitrary line then? I mean, it's the individual, right?
Correct. I mean, the line is drawn at age 70 for a number of reasons and mostly based on life expectancy. So if you really read the guideline, you know, screening sort of stops at age 70, but it also says, or when patient life expectancy is no longer 10 to 15 years.
When we were talking before the show, I said, I get this screening every year. Now, having the screening is much less intrusive or involved in what happens after maybe you have an increased level of risk. Talk about some of the impacts of those things, because those are more intrusive, a bigger story.
Yeah, exactly. And that's sort of what really drives this decision-making process, right? So the screening tool is a blood test, right? So that's pretty simple.
Easy.
You go in, you get your blood drawn, you get a result. But the question becomes then, you know, if your level is elevated, what do you want to do with that information? Because to actually diagnose prostate cancer requires a biopsy, which again is not the most invasive thing in the world, but it's a lot more invasive than a blood test and does come with some risk. And then let's say you find a non-aggressive prostate cancer on that biopsy and you're age 82 or 83. You know, is that something that you really want to be dealing with, or would you have honestly rather not known?
But what, I guess that's the question, because like, what is how long can you live with a non-aggressive prostate cancer diagnosis?
Yeah, great question. A very, very long time.
Really?
Absolutely. So, you know, prostate cancer is graded on a scale of 6 to 10. It's called a Gleason score, which has been in the news quite frequently this past week.
Which is different than stage 4 cancer.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So a Gleason score is basically a pathologist will take the biopsy sample and look under a microscope at the cells from the biopsy and then assign a number to what the cells look like. And based on that appearance of the cells, a Gleason score is given to the cancer.
So a 9 score, which I think what President Biden had, What does that tell you?
So a 9 is an aggressive prostate cancer. So typically Gleason score 8, 9, and 10 cancers are considered clinically significant and aggressive. And you know, at most phases of life, those cancers would be treated aggressively with either surgery or radiation. Gleason score 6 cancer, especially in a low volume, can be a very different type of cancer. And you know, our current guidelines recommend actually surveillance without radiation or surgery.
Go ahead.
You raise an interesting point, though. It's not unique to prostate cancer. Everyone has a decision to make in their lives based on their age, based on their risk, and based on their life expectancy. So this is not unique. If you have an assessment that you have some risk, that's up to the individual, their family, what they decide to do, right? And what their doctor's advice.
Absolutely. I mean, this is really a very thorough conversation that we typically have between the physician and the patient's family as to, you know, do you want to continue screening? And, you know, while the guidelines say to continue screening to age 69, I certainly have some patients who have a lot of other medical issues and say at age 62, you know, I really don't want to do this anymore. Even if I were to have, you know, be diagnosed with prostate cancer, I probably wouldn't want anything done. So what's the point of doing the screening?
It hits me close to home because I had a friend that one of my hunting buddies who died of prostate cancer, and his was like, he didn't go. He was one of these no doctor guys, right?
Sure.
We all have friends like this. They don't
typically men.
Typically men, yeah,
for sure.
As the doctor can probably
sure.
attest.
And he went from diagnosis to death pretty quickly in his 60s. Those are frustrating. I guess the thing that bothers me about one, I'm bothered by people who don't use doctors because in many cases the stuff's paid for. Right.
For sure.
Especially a wellness check.
Absolutely.
Or if I've got an annual physical every year for like the last 40 years. It's not a big deal, folks. And obviously, if you have other things, other risks, it's something you should do. I guess my question for you is, because I know you have a tight schedule. I'm curious what you think as a doctor about all the layperson advice and speculation and this involvement in what really is a personal decision of the president and his family and his physicians.
Yeah, I mean, I think prostate cancer screening is a very important part of men's health. I mean, I would certainly tell people, you know, get your PSA checked. It's an important screening tool. It's the best screening tool that we have for prostate cancer. Yeah. And certainly for young, healthy men, aggressive prostate cancer is a problem, just like your friend experienced, unfortunately. I mean, it's a real disease, especially in its aggressive forms. And I think even for young, healthy men to know that you have, you know, if we diagnose a less aggressive cancer, it's still important to know that because you have a long life ahead of you. We want to make sure that things don't change. Cancers can mutate and get more aggressive with time. And if we haven't identified that, we don't know that and we can't keep working with you. But certainly it's a very personal decision, you know, when to stop these screening tests. And as men age and additional health problems sort of accumulate with time, the question becomes when can we stop, you know, carefully screening for prostate cancer.
The deadly rates, where does prostate cancer fall, like all the other kinds of cancer? Do you know?
I mean, it is not nearly as lethal, and especially in its less aggressive forms. You know, aggressive prostate cancer will still kill men, unfortunately, yeah. as your friend experienced. But compared to the percentage of men who do get diagnosed with prostate cancer, certainly it's less lethal than some of the cancers that people hear about, pancreatic cancer and other things like that.
And how... Knowing that for President Biden, it is metastasized to the bone, is there still is that how serious is that versus like, all right, this is now the plan to treat you?
Yeah, so certainly, you know, more serious than if it had not metastasized a diagnosis, but certainly still, you know, a cancer that treatments exist for, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, typically first line therapy for that sort of disease would be hormonal therapy given to decrease testosterone levels.
I don't want to let you get out of here without giving people just an indication of if what are some of the things, warning signs that they should be concerned about if to suggest they may be, you know, at risk?
Yeah, honestly, one of the problems we have with prostate cancer is that it typically doesn't have a lot of symptoms, which is why we really rely on PSA screening. The other potential test that can be done to help to identify prostate cancer in the screening phase is a digital rectal exam, which is basically a finger exam through the bottom to feel the prostate. That is not done as frequently as it once was because it's found to be not quite as useful as we once thought it was.
I'm not sure why, because I have my doctor's once a year.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
why is that a big deal for people? I don't get it.
It's a very reasonable thing to do. It's you know, it's not that uncomfortable
before you know
it's done. Correct.
Yeah,
correct.
They're good at it. They know what they're doing.
Absolutely.
I love the wisdom.
The wisdom is great.
It's awesome.
See, this is why you talk to actual professionals.
Yes.
Who went to school for this stuff and do this day in, day out.
Social media
don't trust
experts.
Twitter. Don't get your medical advice from Twitter. All right. Dr. Keekly, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Great to meet you.
You as well.
All right. We'll be back with more after this. Thank you again to Dr. John Keekly, who is a urologist at Aurora Healthcare. That was wonderful. It's good to hear from experts. Awesome.
Yeah, an actual subject matter expert.
Yeah.
So when we have guests on, we actually bring people that actually know what the hell they're talking about.
Because you and I don't know everything.
No, and I admit that, unlike some other people who do what we do. All right, I was fascinated by this dog and pony show in the White House yesterday.
I'm so confused where this conversation came from as far as the genocide that is happening to white farmers in South Africa.
Yeah.
I mean, because as we're not going to talk about it today, there are actual genocides happening that were well documented, and you can't turn on, at least for me, I can't go on social media without seeing more updates
around
what's happening around the world, both in Sudan and the Congo, Gaza. This was the first I'm hearing, to steal a line from President Trump, this is the first that I'm hearing about this.
Yeah, which is a common answer. So this one, the only kernel of truth is, yes, there were some white farmers killed. There was also black farmers killed at a much, much higher level. But here's the problem I have with this. One, if you're a foreign leader, do not agree to go sit in the Oval Office with the President of the United States. He's going to make you look bad. This is what he does. It's his real-life presidential version of the boardroom when he did the show.
Yeah.
Where he brought him in and then he acted like an idiot in front of him and he made his decision. You're fired. You're not fired. Whatever. So this is that version of that. So stop doing that because you're always going to look bad. Two, this story does not merit this sort of coverage. It's not the reality. It's some of the documentation that he provided. One was a video. One was a picture. One of them was in the Republic of Congo, not even in South Africa. It's like, what are you doing here?
But I also don't understand because this was right after his speech. His foreign policy speech when he was in the Middle East about how the U.S. isn't going to lecture over human rights anymore, right?
Yeah.
That was last week. And yet, this is the one genocide, even if it was true, which is not, that he cares about?
I guess. You know, part of it is the Elon Musk influence because he's from South Africa, right? And he's mad because they're not hiring his companies to do stuff. And he feels,
oh, is that why?
Oh, yeah. There's a whole piece of that thing.
Oh, I missed that part.
Oh, yeah. So he's angry about that. He doesn't feel he's getting his due as a richest man in the world, billionaire guy, tech guy, that he's not getting his due in South Africa.
In his own home country.
Frankly, South Africa is probably exercising some good judgment and not trusting everything that Elon Musk says, which I think is a good recipe for all of us. He may be smart in some things. He's also a dumb you-know-what in a lot of other things. My take, my hot take. Point taken?
Point taken.
All right, Kristen and Steve, 620 WTMJ. Oh, yeah, some Aerosmith, one of my favorite albums of all time. Poison the Attic, I believe. You can look it up. I could be wrong, but I don't think so. It's also on their greatest hits album, at least one of them. Well, probably a live album as well. Love Aerosmith. That was the music of my high school. At sort of the...
So you were the Dazed and Confused class.
Yeah.
Oh, so when you watch that movie, does
which
that
character
ring
am I?
True?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about that. Which character are you? Don't say...
Yeah.
Don't say Matthew McConaughey.
No. It's too much self-discovery.
About these high school girls.
Yeah. somebody asked me about the Hawaii trip. Yes, there's still spots, but they go fast because we're already in the 20s. And it'll... trust me, this is a popular trip, and it's one that... I know Fox World Travel loves sending people to Hawaii, and this is my 50th of 50 states, and I'm very excited about that. But we will take the time to spend a lot of time at Pearl Harbor, because that's important to me. I've been to Normandy, I've been to Arlington National Cemetery, and these things matter to me, and to honor the individuals who gave their lives that day.
Memorial Day coming up.
Yeah, I mean, these are the people that we're talking about when we talk about Memorial Day, so that's a big part of this. There's a lot of fun on this trip, too, but that'll be a solemn trip, and one that we certainly, I wouldn't go there without doing that, so that's part of that. I just encourage you, if you want to go, don't wait. You can put a deposit down. You can certainly make a different decision later, but there's a great early booking discount that you should take advantage of if you're thinking about going. So
how long does the early booking discount?
That ends pretty soon. Okay. I think it ends, I don't want to say this month. It could be next month.
Feels very early. This is like a year and a half out.
We typically don't do it that far ahead, but we want to sort of plan next year because I'm always talking about the next trip, right? I still have my Sicily Malta trip, which sold out this October. These are fun trips, and I will tell people the difference between maybe my trip and some other people's trip. I get involved in everything, you know, to your discretion, to what you want to do. I will sit with you. We'll have political conversations if you want to, not generally group conversations about the politics. We'll talk sports. We hang out. Whatever you need.
Playing drinking games?
We drink together.
But no drinking games?
I don't remember if we had drinking games. But
games at all? Did you bring like a cribbage board or anything?
No, we played bags last time. And I always
who brought a bags board?
It was on the ship.
Oh,
it was a cruise. So we had, nice. And Kathy and I were champions, not just for our trip, our 40-some listeners, but for the ship.
Wow. Wow.
The cool part about that story, Kathy.
Who's better, you or her?
I am, because she had only played like once before in her life.
But she just had like luck?
She had a day where it was, she couldn't
miss.
That
arm was just.
And she's an athletic person if she wants to be. Although today she has a sore neck and she's not happy about it. Poor lady's working too hard in retirement. What's that about?
All right, we gotta get news.
Just me yakking away. All right, news is next. We got a great second hour. Don't forget Salute to Service, 11:35. They're all great. This was an amazing story. Firefighters, you want to be here for that one.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Braun.
Oh, yeah. Second hour, Point Taken, Kristen and Steve. And don't forget Salute to Service coming up at the bottom of the hour for you kids out there. That's 11:30. We always talk to him on Thursdays. He's one of the best local writers on politics and more, culture. What else do you cover, Jeremy Janine?
Lots of real estate. Anything.
Yeah. Say lots of business.
Business, sure.
You're anything. Like a rarity now because you cover a lot of different things. A lot of the reporters are narrow focused now.
Well, your beat is Milwaukee.
Yes, city of Milwaukee. So I stop at 124th Street. You know,
that's it. You won't drive your car past that.
My bus pass doesn't get me that far.
Oh, look at you making a political point right there. All right. So Chris and I spent some time talking about the RNC the other day, I think.
When the report came out, first thing in the morning. So yes, the RNC impact report is out. Now, it was sponsored by the RNC committee. I don't know if that taints it all, because it was an outside group that actually did the report, right?
And it's the same group that did a report in Chicago. One question I have off the bat that I don't have an answer for is, why did Chicago's report, same group, come out in October? Chicago had the DNC, for those that don't remember.
Oh, yeah.
Why did Milwaukee's take until May? I don't have an answer for that yet. Okay. I don't know that I'll ever get one, but it is a question I have.
That is a question. All right. So as far as we know, the top line numbers, $321 million economic impact. We already talked about that. And then we also talked about, you know, there was some winners and losers that we knew right away that happened, right? There was a lot of outside of the restaurants that expected a lot more business than they ended up having. A lot of the hotels obviously did very well. But as far as your interpretation of reading through this, what are some of your takeaways?
So I look at that $321 million number, and I immediately, that's indirect and direct spending. I immediately cut it down to really that $216 million direct spending. That's money that we know was spent. We can actually walk it backwards and figure out where it came from. That's still more than was estimated.
Yeah.
Although then you have to look at, what is that money? Well, when they're initially talking about the RNC coming to Milwaukee, it was a $50 million security grant. Well, that went up to $75 million. So that was $25 million for free. When we look at a local impact, that went to pay people to secure the RNC, but as we know, that went to a lot of police officers that probably took that money home with them. Mm-hmm. Now, if we took that money home with them to Janesville or to Fond du Lac, we're happy with that. That's money that stays in the state. If they took it home to Columbus, Ohio, that's less of an economic impact.
Although they had to stay somewhere and eat somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know how they certainly ate somewhere. A lot that is also covered somewhat in the security grant, because as we joked about going back 2 years ago, there was, you know, buying insane millions of dollars of I was going to say Jimmy John's, that's the wrong word, meat sticks and all kinds of apples and bananas. Like, the city had to buy all that stuff to feed these police officers while they're here. And let's not focus too much on that. Just know $75 million of the $300 or $200 million is just a federal grant. There was also the $70 or so million raised by the host committee. That money ends up going to pay for the venues. It goes to the RNC to actually host the event. That's a good chunk of change. A lot of that just goes locally in the end, because it, like the Wisconsin Center District I was reporting on, and we'll talk about that in an upcoming item. They got $4 million directly from just renting out the Baird Center. Then they estimate they got another $2 million in food and beverage sales. Like, that's real money. Mm-hmm. People have it. I'm going to switch hats for a moment. I'm going to put on, I also own a gift shop, Urban Milwaukee, the store. Our experience was mixed during the convention. We're right by the Pfister Hotel on Milwaukee Street. So
was probably sold out.
It was sold out and had a hard security perimeter around it. That's where Trump was staying. That's where Mike Johnson was staying. They were all inside the Pfister. There was a solid concrete fence wall between us.
How did you describe your performance in the store?
It was mixed. Now,
what does that mean?
Exact. First 3 days, we're like, oh, this is kind of bad. Like, and they were okay days, but if you compare just to a normal July, mid-July day, it was the same, if not a little bit worse. Then we had that last day of the convention. And this is purely my anecdote of my experience. It was like every security guard, private security guard in town came over and had to buy something to bring up for his kids.
Yeah, souvenirs, yeah.
And we had one of our best days ever. So when I look at the entire convention, yeah, we did better than usual, but for those couple days, not great.
I always love the quotes that you have in your articles, and one of them is from Omar Sheikh, who obviously runs
right
Carnivore and Third Street Market Hall. We had a really solid week. RNC events generated about 30% more than we do in a normal week. So I love that for the local folks here and all these restaurants that are and cool places that are in the Third Street Market Hall. The other one that stood out to me was more of a negative, and that came from Marina Dmitrievich. From the Common Council, her quote, it didn't trickle into the neighborhoods. And you and I were talking during the break. I don't know. Bayview's sort of a reach for me. RNC's downtown. Are they going to go to Bayview? I guess maybe. There's not a lot of hotels there.
So the first caveat, the line above that explains that she actually said this in September when the council discussed what they wanted to see out of the economic impact report, the details. Many of those details didn't end up in the report of let's look at the geography of where the money went. Bayview being 3 miles from Milwaukee, there was this kind of promise, not explicitly, but implicitly sold that, hey, your business is going to get bookings for all these different things. None of that seemed to happen. And that's where the real frustration is. The spending was concentrated downtown.
Arguing that point. I know she's not a big fan of Republicans.
That's
no, fair. She should celebrate the fact. I know Marina because from my days as mayor, I had a lot of run-ins with her. She's not a fan of Republicans. Now, certainly she was hoping that Bayview was impacted. And there's a lot of great restaurants at Bayview. I've eaten at almost all of them. So I get what she's saying. It's just like, I don't know if they're going to... Oak Creek restaurants probably didn't see a blip up, and that's not that much farther. So I guess I don't really put much stock in that. My take.
It's hard to... I think there were a lot of business owners across the city who had really been sold this hope that you should really stock up and you should really get ready.
Yeah.
And none of that materialized for them unless they were... the Omar Sheikhs that were across the street from the security perimeter.
All right, we're just getting warmed up with Jeremy Janine, Urban Milwaukee. How do folks find out about your great work?
UrbanMilwaukee.com.
Make it so easy. Like how I teed it up there, too. All right, Steve and Kristen, point taken. Lots more to get to after this on 620 WTMJ.
It is Point Taken with Steve and Kristen, and on Thursdays we talk to Jeremy Janine, editor.
That's the one job title I don't have.
What is your founder,
president, janitor. Accountant.
Janitor.
I found myself sweeping a floor this morning.
Okay. Janitors are almost always the smartest people.
Every
in the
title
room.
But editor of Urban Milwaukee.
Yes.
Jeremy Janine. All right, so we were just talking about the RNC financial impact, economic impact report. Part of that was the Wisconsin Center District. But now, fast forward to today, and there is a fight emerging between the Wisconsin Center District and the city of Milwaukee. What is going on there?
It's been slowly brewing since April 2020, if you can remember what you were doing.
April 2020?
April 2020.
Okay.
The Wisconsin Center District was trying to finance the Baird Center expansion there. Marty Brooks took what appears to be a very wise bet and said, we need to move forward now. He didn't know this massive inflation was coming, and that ultimately did ensnare the project. But he's, let's move forward now in the expansion. There were multiple members on the Common Council led by Robert Bauman who weren't as excited about moving forward at that point. They were a bit pessimistic about convention business. Marty Brooks was proven right there, but they reached a revenue sharing agreement with the council. And I won't go into the exact details there, but it was, if we have more than $1 million in profit, we being the Wisconsin Center District, we'll share some of that back with the city. And the rationale there was the Wisconsin Center District's actually a government entity. Part of its funding is a hotel room tax that the city of Milwaukee used to have to build what was the Midwest Airlines Center. The city gave up that tax. So it said, you're turning a profit now. Give us some of it back. The Wisconsin Center District said, sure. Here's how we define net income. Here's how we define net revenue. If you remember, and it'll be coming up in weeks in the future, the city attorney at the time, Tyrone Spencer, was not doing a great job. And so he didn't review this agreement. And the city signed on the dotted line for this deal that has paid them essentially nothing.
Oh, God.
Because the Wisconsin Center District, when it defines net income, gets to remove all this stuff. So the city says, let's go back to the bargaining table. And we're finally back with a new agreement.
So the new agreement is different in what way?
It actually has a defined cash payment. No fancy lawyer language. It's $500,000 a year. And then it increases by 2.5%. But it comes with some strings.
So isn't that the Wisconsin Center District bargaining in good faith?
I would say so. What's the fight?
The fight is that we got our first preview of it yesterday, and it's clear Robert Bauman is again leading the charge on the Common Council, saying we to his colleagues at the city, we wasted our leverage. We could have gotten more money. And two, I don't want to approve this deal because the Wisconsin Center District's being petty. They want to give us $500,000 a year, increasing annually. But they also want us to waive certain fees that amount to $23,000 a year. And that's just a personal beef between Robert Baumann and Marty Brooks.
So ultimately, where does this go?
It goes to the Finance and Personnel Committee, which goes to Marina Dmitrievich, to come full circle to our last segment. There'll likely be a closed session briefing next week to discuss this. I expect the city's going to pass it, but I don't think it's going to be a unanimous vote. I think we're going to have some hard feelings, and the hard feelings will continue on the Wisconsin Center District side too, I assume.
General question about the Milwaukee Common Council. Are they on the same page? Are they working effectively together? Because you go to the meetings. I don't. Like, where are they at?
All 15 of them?
Yeah.
They're not on the same page.
What's the breakdown?
But does that surprise you?
No.
But the breakdown is different on the issues. There is at times, I can dramatically oversimplify this.
And, go ahead.
There's a racial line at times on the council.
That I understand.
And that line, unfortunately, because of just how Milwaukee is also a wealth line, a poverty line enough. There's also slight politics lines.
How about the socialist line? How about that line?
But also for Baumann, because Baumann, part of his district is very poor. And then part of his district is downtown.
Yes.
And so it feels like he's one of the few aldermen who probably actually has constituents that fall in the range of the financial demographics of the city, right?
Yeah, and he is a true politician that knows how to make deals. So he's willing to line up on either side of the issue. There's a couple we have, and Steve was just going there. Alex Brower is a new member. This might be the first really contentious issue he ends up in. He's a self-declared socialist. That's a new dynamic on the council. The council has definitely, since the era of Bob Donovan, moved to the left. But even when Bob Donovan was there and a couple other conservative members, they were kind of outliers.
Who's the most conservative in the Common Council right now?
Ooh, that's
a good question.
I might wager, and I'd have to really look at the list again, but Lamont Westmoreland maybe, but in a way that you would not expect traditional conservative. He's just more of a law and order, I want the city cleaned up type.
Would Dmitrievich fall into the socialist camp? Is she Workers' Party or something like that?
Working Families Party. Yeah, yeah. I would. She's a proud Democrat.
Okay. All right.
When is Brower going to bring up the We Energies thing?
I mean, that
was his inaugural speech, but...
He brought it up yesterday.
Okay.
There was a large discussion about speed humps, and people were his constituents didn't want speed humps in certain spots. And he was like, there are two things in the city. First, everyone agrees they dislike We Energies, and then they agree that they want reckless driving addressed. And so he brings it up when he gets his chances.
That made me just think of something. So I've been driving around in the streets of Milwaukee recently to go to different places, and these bump outs, I think those work pretty well, don't they?
And so bump outs, for people that don't know what they are, you're extending the curb into the street. You're narrowing the street.
It does avoid the people that try to rip down the right side.
Absolutely. There's a key thing, the width, even if before even laying concrete on the ground, if you just paint the lane narrower, people slow down. If you think about it on the freeway lane is wider than a traditional city street lane. That's part of why you feel comfortable driving faster through it. The bump outs do make an effect. The city has data that they cause you to slow down just intuitively. You see stuff in your vision, you drive slower.
I do feel bad for the bus drivers.
Yeah.
Those things that can't be easy to drive a bus.
It's already hard. And then you got to add that to the mix.
I'm not saying they're a bad thing. I think they have worked and I appreciate them.
Are you talking about speed humps though? Not bump outs are not something you drive over.
No, but
I know,
you
but
go
I'm saying you have
them.
To go, you gotta try to drive, like, make a turn around
at
them.
Some point.
I think they're the professionals that know how to turn.
It's probably.
The lady that was honking at me on my bike the other day that didn't understand that she couldn't drive across the lane I was in.
Yeah. I actually saw someone drive over one of these bump outs too. It's like, do you not see the yellow paint on the curb there? Like, what are you looking at?
The city has had a problem pouring some of them, the contractors for the city, because while they're pouring them, people keep running them over.
Yeah.
All right, let's take one more break, and we'll have one more segment with Jeremy Janine on Point Taken.
All right, a few minutes left with Jeremy Janine. Does everything
except be an editor.
Editor at the UrbanMilwaukee.com is where you can find the great writing. And you know, I say it every time he's on, but I mean, you want good, great local reporting, that's where you find it. So thanks for the good work on that. Are we talking about population, city of Milwaukee population?
Yeah.
So what is the revision here, I guess?
So in March, when it was political power hour, Steve and I, we talked about the county level data that showed Milwaukee County for the first time in a decade added people, 2,800 basically. And that
2,800 people.
Yeah. Okay. Which for reversing a decade of decline, it was, you got to start somewhere.
Yeah, mm-hmm. For sure.
That was good news, but we didn't know where in Milwaukee County they were from. They could have been in Glendale.
Bayview!
We still don't have that detailed of a data, but it does seem like I have some new neighbors. but we now know with the new U.S. Census Bureau data that Milwaukee, the city of Milwaukee, as well as Milwaukee County, reversed a decade-long decline it gained 479 people. And one of those, if I do my math correctly, is Frankie. So thank you, yes. Kristen and Michael. But that sounds like good news. Things are going up. But if we go back to 2020, the city unfortunately still has substantially fewer people. In 2020, the Census Bureau said that Milwaukee had 577,000 people. It's now at 563,000 people.
Wow.
That's kind of a trend we're seeing around the country with these kind of slow growth or no growth cities. I looked at Baltimore. That's just ahead of Milwaukee on the list. Albuquerque, though, quickly climbing the list. Milwaukee could soon fall to the 32nd largest city.
I can remember driving down Howell Avenue past the airport, and there was that population sign. It was like 602. It was before that. It was 617 or 613. You know, I love the city of Milwaukee. I think it's a fantastic city. It deserves a better reputation. And we all big cities have problems, and we certainly have ours, but it has so many cool things going for it. And I just, you know, this is why I love talking about the city. This is why I love the fact that you're part of the show, because there are things we can sell about this community. I want to see that number go up. And I guess whether it's, you know, the new exciting developments that we're seeing along, you know, the Summerfest area with all these condos that are going up, which condos are a good thing. Maybe it's the decision to start looking at some of the lower income housing and how we can make that more affordable for people and look better and look nicer. There's opportunity here. And I do support the mayor in his initiative to sort of make, not going to hit a million, not in our lifetimes, but
not during his tenure, I would imagine.
Or our lifetimes, probably. Let's be honest. Maybe yours. Maybe
unless there's some kind of climate catastrophe in all the southern states that have been growing exponentially lately.
We become Florida North.
Flee back to the Rust Belt sooner than expected.
On that point, though, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
But it might happen in my lifetime, by the way. Maybe not your lifetime.
You guys are youngsters. I shouldn't have said that. But maybe, and this is sort of a Republican talking point, maybe getting rid of a state income tax would drive people back to the state and Milwaukee.
I mean, getting rid of snow and ice would probably do the most.
Which kind of is happening, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how many times did it snow this last winter?
That's a fair point.
And it's still the stereotype of what people think of when they think of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, but our winters compared to when I grew up and when you grew up, certainly when you grow up, as I'm pointing to all of them, that no one can see, is a lot easier.
Yeah, I have these memories as a kid of having a lot more snow, and I don't know if I just got taller or the snow got shorter.
Texture says Milwaukee was 717,000 in 1970.
But I guess,
did you say that?
I did. 741,000 is the number I have in my article. We had a really smart commenter in Milwaukee. It broke down. There was a fight about annexation, and the population was even larger.
Going backwards, a texter says, this is from a truck driver, narrowing the streets make it difficult and dangerous to navigate when you're a truck driver. I mean, that's something to pay, because there's a lot of deliveries that happen in the streets of Milwaukee. We have a lot of small business.
One of the things cities across the country are grappling with is what's called curbside management. How do we, with these DoorDashers, Ubers, how do we create spaces when they need to pull over to create that space?
All right, we got like 30 seconds. What are you covering this week? What are you looking ahead to?
Well, I was with some fine gentlemen, Eric Bilstad and Vince Vitrano, last night at the Summerfest food unveiling.
That's just an excuse to eat and drink for free.
And now I have to publish photos of it.
Yeah, just to prove you're there.
There is, at the complete opposite end of the spectrum, there's Robert F. Kennedy made a statement that there's this team of CDC people in Milwaukee. They're certainly not here, says the Milwaukee Health Department, covering that as well. And a lot of other small odds and ends on UrbanMilwaukee.com.
Hearing the stories and recognizing the heroes in our lives that continue to make a difference. This is Steve Scafidi's Salute to Service, presented by Waterstone Bank. Here's Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bry.
Always love sharing these stories every year. We do it in the, I think the third week of May around this time. And today is a good story. It's one of those stories that sort of, I think really demonstrates what we talk about when we highlight first responders, the challenges, the risks, certainly, and in this case, an ending that worked out. And I think I'm excited about this one. I love all the stories, but we have a great studio full of great guests today. Leading us off, Chief of the Milwaukee Fire Department, Aaron Lipsky. Good morning.
Good morning.
And we have two firefighters. One is Lieutenant Ben Baus.
Good morning.
Good to see you. And then Ryan McManaman, firefighter for the city of Milwaukee. I don't really want to do much more because I want to play the feature that we interviewed all of you last week. So I want to let the feature speak for itself, because yesterday I stepped all over the feature and I got yelled at. So I'm not going to do that today. But it is a piece that we put together based on just getting the story. We'll fill in the gaps after that, but I want to play the feature now on this great story. And the cool part about this is co-honorees. I'm not sure I've ever done this in the history of this salute. So, very cool story.
Hello, I'm Chief Aaron Lipsky, Milwaukee Fire Department. I am nominating Lieutenant Ben Baus and Firefighter Ryan McMenamin. April 14, 2024, right around 5 in the morning, report of a house fire on South 8th Street. Companies responded in. They found one house very well involved in fire that appeared to be vacant. That fire quickly spread to a house to the north and a house to the south. We were able to quickly evacuate people in the house to the north. However, there were some folks that had trouble getting out on the house to the south.
Me and Captain Leshinsky were tasked with going into that house to get all the occupants out of that house.
They removed one individual off the first floor.
I started to walk him outside. He said that his wife, who was disabled, was on the second floor. And Captain Leshinsky said that he was going to start to make his way up there and start to work to get her out.
At this point, the building is starting to clearly be attacked by the fire from next door.
The conditions were not in our favor.
What folks might not understand is when we arrive and now there's three buildings involved, we're outmatched right off the bat.
Captain Leshinsky was having issues getting the patient out. He ended up falling down a flight of stairs, trying to maneuver her out and around stuff that was piled on the stairs. I started to go up, and I almost had hands on the patient, and they both started screaming, "We gotta go, we gotta go." As I started coming back down the stairs, I noticed that I had fire coming up above me in the stairwell, and I was able to basically retreat to the front of the house on the second floor. The window that was there was boarded up, and due to the burns that I had sustained on the first floor, I didn't have much dexterity with my hands, and I was able to call for help.
I was in radio communication with them leading up to the event. What Ryan did on that day was nothing short of incredible.
It was the relying on the training that I've gotten to be able to react that I think was what truly saved my life.
Ryan's ability to remain calm, answer questions on the radio, lead us to him, gave him his best chance of survival, allowed us to execute a rescue and help him out. And once I got to him, it was just a huge sigh of relief to see him. There's a lot of other firefighters on this job that could have been put in this position. This may not work out the same way.
I was transported to St. Mary's Hospital. They said that I had 23% burns. I had three surgeries for skin grafts. I spent 27 days at St. Mary's Burn Unit and had phenomenal care from the staff there. They were amazingly wonderful. My family, my girlfriend, both of our families jumped in and helped out every day. But the fire department was, I had probably more visitors than the rest of the hospital. It seemed like every day there was probably 30 to 40 people that were coming up. The attitude that they brought was contagious.
About 8 months after his injuries, Ryan McMenamin returned to full duty. He's back on the south side, aboard Engine 23. Ryan, thank you so much for your dedication, for your heroics, and your service. Ryan, please stand and be congratulated. Thank you, Ryan.
What does Salute to Service mean to you?
It means a lot. I'm very honored. I stood several years ago and put my hand up and said that this was the job that I was going to do and people shouldn't expect anything less. So I'm very honored. I think it's a great thing to recognize people and really kind of show people that go above and beyond. And Chief Lipsky and Lieutenant Baus, I think, are examples of that.
And Baus, what does Salute to Service mean to you?
Well, it's truly an honor to be sitting here, but to me, this is truly a representation for really our company. It's a privilege to work on Rescue One. It's an honor and privilege to work with the men and women I get to work with, and the way that they showed out and worked on this day, it's just an honor to be a part of it.
Our fourth and fifth honorees for Waterstone Banks Salute to Service. And we'll take a break, but joining us in studio, Chief Aaron Lipsky, Lieutenant Ben Baus, and Firefighter Ryan McMenamin, along with his girlfriend Lauren. We'll hear more of the story and sort of explore some of the things that I heard in that piece, which I love when I hear training, because I know Chief Lipsky a little bit, and training is such a big part of that. And I think that's one of the reasons we had the outcome that we did. So we'll continue the conversation with our guests. It is Salute to Service presented by Waterstone Bank on 620WTMJ.com.
I'm Annie Schwartz. You're listening to Salute to Service.
Thank you, Annie Schwartz, frequent guest on the program, law enforcement communications expert. It is Salute to Service presented by Waterstone Bank. We have a great story today. As I said at the beginning, Chief Aaron Lipsky, Milwaukee Fire Department, Lieutenant Ben Baus, and firefighter Ryan McMenamin, joints co-honorees, which I'm pretty sure I've never done before. I'm going to go to Lieutenant Ben Bowes first. Let's get your mic on. Is his mic on? Say something.
Hello.
All right. So he's like the shyest of the group, I think, but obviously good at your job. We heard some of it in the piece, but your involvement in this story and how you, I guess the training part is the part, how you were able to do what you did in aspect of Ryan McMenamin.
Sure. This is something that we prepare for, you know, really on a daily basis. Something that we hope we don't ever have to really get put in to do, but we're ready for it. And as a company officer in a rescue company, I'm very fortunate with the people that I get to work with. You know, training is a very important job, and it's part of my job to make sure that the members that I work with are, you know, prepared and ready on a daily basis to do whatever I ask them to do. And, you know, when it's very easy to get buy-in. So, we train daily. They're always, you know, willing participants and ready to learn and honestly ready to teach me. We learn from each other. And, you know, we put a lot of work in towards this type of stuff. And when the moment came and Ryan was in need and other members needed help, we all worked together well, and we were able to do a lot of good on 414.
And sort of the same question, Ryan, you obviously were someone who was severely injured here. Like, what was the number, 23% over your body?
Yep, correct.
I mean, when you face these situations, you know that any day that you go to work, this might be something that you have to face, and it doesn't stop you from doing the job. And I think that is training, right?
Absolutely. And I think that's what helps promote the training, is the fact that we want to come home and we want to prepare for every situation so that we're able to you know, mitigate it safely. And I think the safest way for us to operate is to be prepared for as much as that we can.
How has this incident, obviously then the physical piece, changed your life?
Everything has kind of come back. You know, I got a few battle wounds, but thankfully the burns didn't cause any major deficits to me. So I'm very appreciative of that. And you know, we're back in action, ready to go.
I was going to say, was there ever a moment in your recovery where you thought you wouldn't go back?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Yep. It was a matter of how long.
And how has it been since being back? Is there any kind of residual feelings as far as when that call comes, or is it kind of just get back in motion?
No, it's get back in motion. I think a lot of it comes down to the trust that we have together. And I know the people that are working beside me are, you know, have my back, and that was definitely proven that day. And, you know, we all look out for each other to try and make things the best that we can for us and for the other people.
And Chief, you always send me great recommendations, and you obviously know your team very well at Milwaukee Fire Department. When I saw this story, I said, I mean, this is a no-brainer. This is a story that we have to tell. When you think about that day, that moment, I think it was 414, right?
Correct.
Yeah, that day. And the work that your two individuals of your great team did, I mean, that has to make you proud.
I have to pinch myself regularly every time I'm reminded that, hey, you're actually in charge of this outfit, you know, because the work that they do, it isn't because I'm showing up saying, you got to do this, you got to train, these folks are so self-motivated. It's inspiring to me. It makes me push harder. But I will tell you that without a doubt, it is the work of these two, but there was an entire team working in pretty unglamorous, unflattering positions, uncomfortable spots. And those things on game day, of course, we celebrate that it came together, but it is that preparation beforehand and everybody that participates willingly and aggressively in that training. That's what allowed all of this to come to be on this day. And these two that we're so lucky to have here with us, they really, really were the exact right people with the exact right preparation at, I don't want to call it the right time, but at a horrible time.
Chief Aaron Lipsky, Lieutenant Ben Bowes, and Firefighter Ryan McMenamin in studio as we celebrate our fourth and fifth honorees, Waterstone Bank Salute to Service. We'll take a break. I want to ask you about service, public service, and firefighting. Kristen and Steve, point taken. Salute to Service on 620 WTMJ.
Back to Steve Scafidi's Salute to Service on WTMJ. Presented by Waterstone Bank. WTMJ.
Honoring our fourth and fifth honorees. Thank you, Waterstone Bank. They're always great stories. We are joined in studio by Chief Aaron Lipsky from the Milwaukee Fire Department, firefighter Ryan McMenamin, and Lieutenant Ben Bouts. I'll start with you, Chief. We only got about 3 minutes or so, but when I talk about salute to service, I want to honor people that do outstanding work on and off duty, 24/7, 365. We sort of hit it in the thing, but salute to service, public service, what does it mean to you specifically?
What it means to me is it is not a title, it is not a rank, it is not anything other than a choice that these two gentlemen and many, many others made to put themselves in harm's way so that others might live. And hats off for that.
All right, Firefighter McMenamin, tremendous story. I'm so happy that you are back to work and going to be able to enjoy a long, successful career. You have to think about these things, though, when you go to work every day, because it's happened to you directly. So I know you could put that aside, but what is it about being a firefighter that just drives you, that makes you want to show up to work every day, even given your story?
A big one is the people that we work with. A lot of like-minded people. We all have, you know, same common interest, and we're all pushing for the same goal at the end of the day. And it's contagious, and it really helps bring everybody up every day and makes it very easy.
How happy were you to see Lieutenant Ben Bouts? I'm assuming through like a face mask or something when he showed up there.
Yeah, there was a very overjoyous moment of joy for me to see him and see the window coming out and seeing some daylight break.
It's just an awesome story. And Lieutenant, you're obviously very good at your job, but I mean, those are things that they don't happen every day on the job. What do you think about when, in terms of your everyday day-to-day work and then that day, how do those two things mesh?
Definitely something that doesn't happen every day. Honestly, I think about it. I'm just, you know, we're thankful Ryan's here. That's the real reward from all of this. But honestly, I just couldn't be more pleased with my company. You know, in a moment where I didn't have time to explain things, their ability to move with a purpose and just accomplish tasks without being told. It's just truly a pleasure to be a part of a rescue company, you know, our HERT team in general. And we're just thankful Ryan's here with us.
Going through that, what have you taken forward with your job? Obviously, this is an unbelievably high pressure situation and that you hope you don't have to be in, but it's also part of the job. And so in the year, right, since? A little bit over a year. What do you feel like either you, I guess Lipsky as well, but have learned from this that you has made you better at your job?
You know, we're constantly learning. We're constantly trying to get better. I think this was just a scenario where it really got real, really fast. And honestly, it's just a good reminder to us that all these trainings are important. Yeah. They're real. They're going to happen. Unfortunately, it's coming again soon, potentially, the way that, the way the challenges that we face on a daily basis. So we're just going to keep, you know, putting our feet to the ground, keep working hard and be ready for it.
There's a lot of perks you get for being an honoree, and we'll get into you next week. But some of the cool ones is you get to go to the Aaron Waters Show and participate and see the Blue Angels, which is very cool. And there's restaurant gift certificates. We have a small little honoree thing that we give you. That all comes to you probably in the mail, or we'll drop it off at your department. I want to thank you, Chief, for, again, your recommendations are always good ones, and we've done a few together over the years. You have great people that work for you, men and women. And we should be proud of our fire department. It's just it all comes together: training, expertise, obviously leadership. And I think you exemplify that. And that's why I'm not surprised that we're talking about this story in the way that we are, because of your leadership.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Salute to Service, presented by Waterstone Bank. We have one more tomorrow. It's a interesting story, father and son, and it goes to the Franklin Police Department. And I haven't told Franklin Police Department, so they're going to be interested in finding out who that is on tomorrow's program. I'll do it about 11:30 tomorrow. She is Chris and I am Steve. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching to all those of you on YouTube and our stream. We'll do it all again tomorrow.